This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 396 for October 20th of 2017, Magna's Supermarket of Automotive Technology. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
All right. We get to do another Autoline After Hours. Gary, good to see you.
Welcome back, John. It's been a while.
Jeez, I've missed the last three shows. I can't believe it. I've got a Jones for doing this show. I'm telling you, I enjoy it that much.
And this will be a good show to be back on.
It will be. And one of the reasons is we got David Welch here from Bloomberg.
Hey, that makes it a great show.
It does. But our special guest is not David. It's Swami Kotagiri, and he is the Chief Technology Officer at Magna, one of the largest automotive suppliers in the world. And Swami, great to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
What is it that you guys don't do? Just give the audience a sense of Magna's magnitude, because, I mean, you guys are into everything.
I always like to go about what we don't do rather than read out the whole list. We don't do corners, which is basically the tires and the wheels and the corner piece of it. We don't do glass. We do some, but not significantly. And we don't do engines, right? Pretty much everything else in a car, in some way, shape, or form, we touch.
In addition to actually assembling cars.
Absolutely.
Magna's the only supplier in the world that assembles cars. And you're doing what? Mercedes, BMW, and soon Jaguar, too.
That's right.
But you've done plenty of stuff in the past. Mini. I can't even keep track of all the different vehicles.
Aston Martin, Mini, many Chrysler versions in Europe that were made, and the list goes on.
And you've got the assembly plant in Graz, Austria.
Yeah.
You guys just announced you're going to have to open a second paint shop because your output is so great.
Yeah, just adding capacity in terms of the programs that John was talking about in terms of Jaguar and BMW and so on. So in addition to that, John, just for the viewers, not just contract manufacture, but have the ability to engineer and put a full vehicle together, right, working with our OEM partners.
So Magna, if you wanted to, you guys could get into the car business.
I think that answer has been very clear. That's not the intent.
You don't want to compete against your customers.
Our own customers.
It was at one point.
That's history in the past. That's why we want to clarify the message from our company. That was very clear. Don has said that in many places, that we want to be the system, subsystem, and the vehicle support to our OEM customers rather than play a role there.
Now, you mentioned that you guys don't do internal combustion engines, but you guys do electrified powertrains. Talk about that.
Absolutely.
You made an announcement this week about that as well.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gary, for bringing it up. I like to say that we bring power to the wheels, right? So whether it be the battery or the ICE engine is the power source. But if you take it from there, it's the transmission, the drive line, basically getting power to the wheel, and some ancillaries, whether it's pumps or, you know, power takeoff units and a few other things. The overall intent is we can address any of the market, which is IC engines, whether it's hybrids or the Ford Focus BEV, which we did in the past, where we supplied the machine, the inverter, and played a significant role in the integration and the overall engineering working with Ford. And the Volvo V60 is another example of a electrified rear augmented axle drive, which actually got the Quality Excellence Award this year for the system. That's a good play or capability demonstrator for the hybrids, and I don't need to talk about the regular IC engines.
Yeah, it almost looks to me going forward that not a whole lot of money is going to be invested in the IC engine. Let me restate that. There will be continued improvements.
Yep.
But I don't see any new all clean sheet engines being developed going forward.
I think, John, there is going to be significant development, I would say, in the downsizing and downspeeding of the existing engines. being supercharged as well as turbo, you know, that's going to be the focus.
Mm-hmm. What wind down speeding?
Sorry?
Why down speeding of the engine?
It's just the efficiency in terms of getting, you know, if you really talk about getting your turbo and supercharging where you need to be, and if you get the advanced combustion processes like the Miller cycle, and if you find a way to get the thermal efficiency where you need to, then you're looking at possible down speeding too, right? So think about it. If you can run on gear 2 with the same torque that you would at gear 3,
right? Okay.
So there's some ways to look at the overall transmission shift strategy, thermal efficiency, and the whole engine mapping and the thermal efficiency part of it. So I think that's going to be an important part.
That would be interesting because presumably if you downspeed the engine,
yep,
you get NVH benefits too, because these days as they downsize engines, they rev higher and the whole car gets kind of buzzy.
And that's the key. You brought one point, that is the NVH. The other aspect is the thermal efficiency, right? You need to have a change in the thought process of how you manage heat. And the better you manage that, the better efficiency you get. So if you look a lot about the Miller cycle and the advanced combustion processes we are talking about, I think there is something still left in the IC engine.
But would these fundamentally be changes to existing powertrains rather than, as John is suggesting, clean sheet approaches to entirely new
It's existing engine platforms. You're right. I don't think it has to be a clean sheet of paper, remelt, repour. So it's building on what is already there, mm-hmm, right? I think the 1.6 to 2 liter with some advanced combustion processes, as well as looking at what you just talked about, turbocharging and supercharging, I think can get quite a bit of efficiency still.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear.
I see the logic of it, because everyone sees electric drive or even fuel cells as really the not-too-distant future. But electric cars are still 1% of the market, and there's really, you know, other than the love affair with the Tesla brand name and the Elon Musk mystique, it really isn't obvious that all these EVs coming to market in the next few years are really, that there's really hot demand for them. In other words, we're going to have gasoline engines, not just on the road, because you've got all the ancient cars that are always out there. You're going to have gasoline engines in nice new cars being sold on new car lots for a long time to come. So is it really wise to stop investing in all new engine platforms? Can you get enough out of what's already out there to, you know, for this potentially long bridge between now and the day when the electric car is reigning over all the new car lot?
Yeah, I think there is going to be a significant change in the hybrid domain. I call it micro, mild, PHEV, all of them put together, where you're really reducing the parasitic losses by providing power where needed, when needed. That is one aspect of it. And like we talked about, the efficiency continuing on the IC engine part of it. And if you think of electrification, we're really talking about driven by CO2 emissions, air quality, NOx particulates, and so on, right? And each one has a different solution. If you're trying to address air quality in a city, maybe you don't need a 300-mile range, right? It's a different type of a vehicle. How you put the modules together could be a different thought process. If you're looking at a CO2, then it's a different topic. And if you're trying to address the fine dust particles and so on, yes, the tailpipe emission is one aspect of it, but you still have the dust from tires and, brakes and so on and so forth. Then there is huge developments going on there too, but it's a pretty complex equation, and I think it's being simplified to say we're addressing a lot of emissions and environment, and let's go all electric.
Do you think, though, that there will be more development dollars spent on e-motors to develop more of them going forward than there would be for ICEs?
Yeah, I think there is definitely going to be a lot of activity on the motor development, let's say, right? And if you talk, there is two areas to be addressed. One is peak power for performance. The other is continuous power. So there's a whole debate on ASM versus PSM. To answer your question, yeah, for sure, there's going to be a lot of work on the the e-machine side of things, not just the motor, but how do you integrate this into different systems? So how does a 7 or 8 speed transmission look in 10 years from now, right? Is it a hybrid? You know, I use the example of dual clutch because we do it. Hybrid dual clutch transmission, right, with an e-machine integrated in it. So there is multiple systems where we are talking of electrified systems coming in together. So that's going to be, I think, the biggest area.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got a couple of questions from guests already. Wright Knight wants to know, is Magna the same as Magna Steyr? I guess I'd say it the other way around. Magna Steyr is part of Magna.
That's absolutely right.
But, yeah, good question, Wright Knight. And then Mike in San Francisco wants to know, do companies like GM and Ford hire Magna to do design work that the car companies do not specialize in?
I don't know whether we can call it whether they do not specialize in, but definitely yes. The OEMs from all aspects engage Magna at different levels of engineering. In some cases, it is the complete system where they give you the specification and we design and build and, you know, go through the whole cradle to grave. And in some cases, like I told you, from a Magna Steyr perspective, it's the full vehicle. Obviously, we work interactively with the OEM. They have the level one spec and the consumer attributes and what's needed in the product. But a significant piece of the subsystem, system, and full vehicle engineering is done by Magna.
And another part of the business is you're coming, and this is where you come in as chief technology officer. You're always cooking up new kinds of things and technologies that you then bring to the car companies. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I think as a good tier one supplier, our intent is to understand the future needs as we see it from the industry perspective. And we call, you know, some people call it a strategy meeting, some call it a roadmap. We have these discussions with pretty much all OEMs. We sit down and tell them this is what we think. From an outside perspective, we see your fleet as an example, right? And we think your CO2 levels are here, and maybe talk about lightweighting and powertrain technologies and aerodynamics and so on. And the best combination seems to be this, right? And that's where, you know, our R&D is driven. That's how we start, you know, getting development projects together.
Mm-hmm. Where are you focusing most these days in terms of your R&D efforts?
There is a lot of focus on electrification and autonomy. I purposely say autonomy because different levels of autonomy. But there is always continued focus on, you know, other things like lightweighting, which are secondary effects, right? You have to continue to look at materials, manufacturing processes, and so on. But significant piece is electrification, autonomy. The third aspect we are looking at in the recent times is what role can we play in the ecosystem of the future mobility, right?
Oh, interesting.
Take an example. If you are looking for a type of a mobility medium, let's say, and you need to have a powertrain platform, or you need to have an electrical electronic architecture as a platform, within obvious bounds, but we can bring that to the table. And maybe a particular OEM wants to do a variant. You know, we are addressing that from a platform strategy perspective rather than just components and subsystems, which is our business, and we'll continue to do that. But that's you know, a role that we continue to investigate.
So this means Magna is proactively developing technologies that could be applicable to vehicle manufacturers that are looking for advancements?
Absolutely. I think that's the example I brought about is if an OEM is looking for a last mile, first mile medium of transportation, right? We should be able to bring that with our knowledge of the subsystems and how different systems act together or interface with each other and our ability to put the whole vehicle together.
Look, we've got a lot more that we've got to talk about here,
yep.
But we've got to take a break, too, because we've got to give a shout-out to our sponsor, Lear, right now, that helps make this program possible.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking with Swami Kotagiri from Magna, the chief technology officer, with David Welch sitting in along with Gary and I. Swami, would Magna consider being a mobility supplier in the future as all this mobility stuff develops?
John, it's a emerging market right now, right? And we got to look into the crystal ball. But do we have the pieces of the puzzle to be able to address that market? We believe we do. And, you know, we have to continue to explore that further. But overall in the ecosystem, you know, working with our OEM partners, I think we can bring a lot more to the table.
So 1 week ago today, you guys made an announcement, BMW, Intel, Mobileye, and Magna.
Yeah.
And you're working together on what?
I think the consortium, as described by BMW, actually is looking at everything from door locks to data centers, as they put it, right? And the intent is to address the fundamental challenge of autonomous driving going forward. How do you get cars to communicate with each other? How do you get cars to communicate with the infrastructure? And there is a whole value chain involved in this, right? And how do you set standards to take this proliferation into the market much faster? And the intent there is to create a platform that is flexible and ready by 2021. And with Magna, who has been in the industry for more than a decade, and we are the leaders in the vision-based ADAS systems today, having the complete sensor suite, whether it be the camera or the radar or the LiDAR or the ultrasonic, and the compute side of things, which is your ECU or the domain controller, we bring to the table the commercialization and the scale aspect of it, and we can do specific applications for any others that would want to use it. We work a lot with BMW on many other products, and this seemed to be a very natural fit.
So it was interesting, you mentioned that you have cameras, so you make lots of cameras. You have a camera plant in Michigan,
yep.
I think, and
yep.
Which is extraordinary in and of itself. But so as a supplier, I mean, you have production-ready systems that can be deployed rather than, you know, theoretical things that are rolling around in a lab somewhere.
Absolutely, and I think the one aspect there is like it's camera is just one aspect of the system we provide, mm-hmm. right? There is a lot more in terms of the software, the sensor fusion side of things, the image processing, and so on and so forth. But this is a continuous process, right? You have a 1 megapixel camera. We're talking of 6, 7, 8 megapixel cameras in the future. The processing is changing. So this is a fast-changing world. So what we bring in terms of credibility, like you said, is I think we produced more than 25 million cameras from that plant over the period of time. So, but we take that as a basis and continue to get to the next step, right? That's just not just the camera piece, right?
Sure.
You know, all the other sensor fusion. And I would like to always look at ADAS now as the features are really the products, right? It's lane keep or lane assist or AEB and, you know, automated valet parking in the future. Everything else are enablers. Today it might be camera and radar. Tomorrow it might be something else. So we look at the whole domain.
How far into the tiers of autonomy is Magna developing?
If you have looked at it, about a few weeks ago, we talked about what we call as the Max 4 platform. And the intent there is to have a technology platform to try all the challenges associated with level 4, right? A lot of level 2 are on the road today, mm-hmm. right? You see a lot more production programs that are being discussed on level 3. So we are participating on all of them.
Swami, what do you think is going to be the shakeout? between make and buy? Because we see automakers like General Motors, Ford Motor Company, seemingly doing everything in-house. We see suppliers like Waymo, even Delphi, developing turnkey systems. And then there's consortiums such as the Intel Mobileye Delphi one, the BMW, the one that you guys have just joined. When it all shakes out, how do you think this is going to look?
I think my perspective, John, it's going to be a lot more collaborative than what the automotive industry has been used to in the past, right? The value chain that we are used to is a little bit different than what, you know, seems to be going forward. It's the tier one suppliers that have been in the game. It's the OEMs, but you also start, you know, the semiconductor chip companies or processing guys. You see service providers, you know, 3G, 4G, 5G, the cloud and the back-end data processing side of things. I think it's going to be a lot more collaborative than everybody trying to own the entire value chain.
You know, it's interesting, your title, Chief Technology Officer, okay? 20 years ago in this industry, there'd be no such thing, okay? And it would all be about, you know, cranking out production, just getting stuff done. When did Magna change to say, we've got to be a company that is on the leading edge of technologies that are or may be of interest to our automotive customers?
When did they fire the chief mechanical officer?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
I'd give a little more credit to the automotive industry. Yeah, the chief technology officers have been there a long time. But I think what you're trying to say, Gary, is what's the change in the thought process and, you know, the job description or the function, right? And to your point, I don't know if it was as much the mechanical officer, but the paradigm behind what you're saying is true, right? Even as Magna, our intent was to looking at product process and materials, right? What products can I bring? How should I change my process to make it cheaper, faster, better? What material should I be looking at going forward to make it either lighter, to get more strength or better features and so on? The fourth category that's been added right now is information and data, right? So all the aspects that we're talking are there. I think what's become more important and people, we believe Magna has an advantage is trying to look at the interface of all these systems, right? I'll give you one. We just talked about a lightweight door study that we just finished and was published. In the past, you would have looked at it only as a door, right? How do I stamp or, you know, how do I put the composite piece together? Now we are looking at what's the actuation system, right? You know, what type of ECU should we put in? What other features can I put in? Can I integrate a radar so, you know, when you open the door, it can detect not to hit, you know, the car next or a pole that is next to you. So if you have the overall understanding of the sensors, the door architecture, the mechanical piece of it, you know, there is an evolution, right? You had a door latch, and maybe it's a different actuator today. If you had a door handle, it might be going away, and it's an e-latch going forward. So I think that is the big shift in the thought process, is don't look at your product, look at the overall system, and what can you do from a system perspective to address that question? I think it's been evolutionary. I would say I've been in this role for 4 years, and it continues to change every month.
Which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay, Wright Knight sent us another one. He says, I recall a Magna SUV concept from years ago. And he's right. You got a good memory, man. Oh, look at that. They got it up there. It was futuristic, and it made me think of an S10 Blazer of the future. What was the name of that thing?
Torero.
It's right. Pretty cool.
Yeah. And this was, that's got to be at least 25 years ago, right?
Yeah, it was in the
25 years
at
old.
Least,
yes.
At least.
Really?
Because it looks like a Land Rover.
I was going to say, it looks like the Evoque.
Yeah.
It was in the early to mid-90s, if I remember, and it still sits in one of our facilities. And from what I heard, it was taken to a few OEMs, and it was said, why would you build something like that? And after about 8 years came the SUV.
Yeah.
So I guess we were a little bit ahead of our time.
Yeah, you were. Well, how do you develop technologies now that don't end up like that?
There is a significant input in some of the things we are talking about, right? There's always a danger of being, you know, ahead of your times. You have to take some stretch goals and targets. I always like to use the example. You have to jump long enough that you sprain your leg, but don't jump too far that you die, right? So you have to stretch to find your limits. We try to understand the overall trends, you know, whether it's regulatory or legislative or, you know, like how much is sharing going to impact, you know, the future, how are cities being planned and should we look at vehicles differently. We try to break it down into subsystems and develop them so there is a adaptation, if not the whole thing, pieces of it, right? That's a mix and match. Mm-hmm.
Do you need to develop battery systems for the kind of electric drive work you're doing, or do you rely on somebody else entirely, you know, basically buy that stuff or just work with Samsung or whichever player you want to?
Right now, we are looking at the market. We don't do cell development ourselves.
Right.
But we look at a battery management system overall, for sure, yes. So to answer your question, we are not looking at the chemistries or the development of the cells itself. We are looking at the market and the big players that are out there, and we are taking the step after.
Because, John, didn't GM outsource a lot of, if not the entire battery system for the Bolt?
It did, but very interestingly, the chemistry of the cell was developed by General Motors. Same with Ford. So they've got Panasonic and LG building the batteries for them, using their, i.e., GM's and Ford's intellectual
property.
Yeah,
so it was the pack design and everything they outsourced.
Correct.
But the actual chemistry, that's interesting.
Yeah. And Swami, I got to believe that one of the toughest parts of your job is saying, no, we're not going to go down that route. We're not going to go invest in that technology because so much has got to be flying at you. And with all the startups that are coming into the business, all the new things that are opening up, I got to believe one of the toughest parts of your job is figuring out, do we get involved in this or not?
Yeah, for sure. And I have a phenomenal team. We all come together in the domains and technical expertise together. But definitely that's one of the toughest but very interesting part of the job too, right? You get to see so much that's happening. Sometimes it's outside the industry. We found some really interesting ideas and concepts from medical industry where robotics was being used to do surgery. And we looked at it and said, if it can have so much dexterity, why cannot I use this for end-of-arm tooling in some of the manufacturing concepts? So you're right. It's very broad, very wide, and I hope I make you know, enough decisions that win. I'm definitely making some that, you know, that we're either missing or we have to
take
on. Well,
like I said before, if you're not straining, you know,
exactly,
you're never going to move forward.
Yep.
Really move the needle. Look, we've run out of time for this segment, but Swami Kotagiri, thanks so much for coming on. Very interesting what you're doing at Magna, and we really enjoy having you share some of your insights with us.
Thanks, John. Always a pleasure.
Very good. We're going to take a quick break, give a shout-out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Very interesting what they're doing at Magna. And, boy,
it is, because a few years ago, they didn't really have much of a technology story at Magna. They were, you know, supplying interiors. They've always done some cool stuff, but, they, you know, Delphi was more the high-tech player than they were, and, you know, some of the companies in Germany. But they're doing some interesting stuff over there now.
Yeah, what's interesting is, okay, so he mentioned just quickly Max 4. Okay, so this is, they developed this platform that's cameras, LIDAR, ultrasonic sensors, and a controller that would be basically level 4, a drop-in that automakers could use. Okay, so they've got that. And remember when we had the MDX in here and we talked about the materials in the hot stamped door ring? Magna. So, I mean,
it's a good point.
So it's all the way from you know,
metal bending
to, you know, the most advanced
level 4
out there.
Right.
Yeah.
This is going to be interesting though, because you have Magna developing autonomous technology. You have Delphi doing it. All the car companies.
Waymo.
Waymo, Apple. as this stuff starts to, you know, really get on the road, people will be getting better at the algorithms, at the software that controls it. And how much of a lead can anyone establish there before, if there's a safe where the government says, hang on, you got to share because we got to have the safest stuff on the road for everybody?
It's a great question. And, you know, that's why I wanted to ask him, make or buy, where's this all going? And I thought his answer was pretty good.
It becomes sort of a standardized thing, right, where you have to be able to...
Well, I think there's going to be huge market advantage for whoever comes out with a truly good level 4 car that has got widespread geofence posts. I think there'll be a massive advantage for who's ever first with that.
Well, but the other part that we have to not lose sight of is the fact that automakers are going to have to rely on reliable suppliers to be able to build this stuff in volume. I mean, someone may be able to come up with something, but, you know, making it is entirely a different story. And I think that is where perhaps traditional suppliers that have kept up with the technology are going to be at a certain advantage versus, you know, this whole notion of, Detroit can't do anything, those suppliers, you know, that they're just tin benders. And
taking that stuff and putting it into a car and making it interact with the mechanical car or the electric cars we get there is not, that's becoming more difficult than everybody thought. I mean, look, at a certain point, Waymo said, we're not going to build the car. Mm-hmm. We're going to build this for the car. And I think Apple has said that too, or
yeah, in
something
fact,
similar, it was although they've been much more murky about where they're going with this. But, you know, I think they've realized out in Silicon Valley, you know, they're good at writing code, at managing data, at coming up with software systems. You know, they're not, you know, do they have great knowledge of supply chain and that sort of thing? I mean, you know, I remember when Apple, you know, when the whole thing broke that they were working on this, everyone said, oh, they're going to make a car and it's going to have this iPhone-type design. And I said, I don't know about that. You know, they don't even build their own phones. They really want to build their own cars.
Right.
But, you know, so your point, make or buy, you know, you may have a handful of companies who are really making the algorithm software and the brains and everybody else buying that and integrating it into vehicles.
Right.
And look, maybe GM's one of those. Maybe Daimler is one of those who makes their own. We'll see.
So yesterday, actually, a Apple autonomous system was captured in the wild. A guy has took a 10-second video of this system that has 6 LIDARs on the roof. And this thing looks Apple-like. I mean, it looks, you know, it's got that Apple design. It's sort of got this stormtrooper white plastic look.
I know Waymo's test car looked kind of Apple-like, the white pods they had going around.
And, they're still working on something at Project Titan, so it hasn't gone away entirely.
Oh, no, its death was prematurely announced. They're definitely working.
Oh, yeah, they haven't given up. No. Okay,
they have too much money.
This is the part of the show where we turn to Dr. Data to befuddle and amuse us.
Okay, this one's going to be tough. Okay, so Carmen, could you please bring up the first slide? Okay, so it's 33% of teens and 27% of parents think something. So, John, you're busy looking at that picture.
Ooh,
I know you're not going to figure this one out.
No, I'm not.
So what would 33% of teens and 27% of parents agree on, and it does have to do with the auto industry?
Well, this is difficult because with a 6% variance there, which could almost be margin of error.
So basically they both agree.
They agree, yeah. So what do teens and parents actually agree
on? What do they agree on? It is shocking. Let me tell you when you see what this is.
Boy, I have no clue. I can't even hazard a guess.
Well, and I'm going to guess this only because you're saying it's shocking that they would agree on this, that teens are bad drivers or unsafe drivers.
No.
Okay.
Carmen, bring up the solution. They think it's legal to drive on weed.
Oh, what? I did see a story about this early in the week.
Yeah, so the National Institute on Drug Abuse did a survey, and this is what they think. They think it's okay. It's legal. And so I was wondering, and I looked.
Well, you know, that's actually interesting, because I could see where they would say that. Not that they're stupid and think, oh, yeah, you can drive high, right? But is there a law? I mean, we know, you know, if you have, what is it, 0.7 percent alcohol in your blood, you're drunk, you're going to go to jail, you're going to get arrested. But is there anything that specifies, if you're high on weed, that it's illegal to drive? I could see where they'd say that.
No, well, here's the thing. I never really put much thought into this, frankly, but I always thought that it was illegal, but I've never heard of someone getting pulled over and taking a blood test, a urine test, or any kind of test that to figure out if they just
measure your Cheetos intake, and they're able to calculate it that way.
They look how many empty snack bags.
Yeah, that's the exact. But so I looked, and 29 states have broadly legalized marijuana. So think about that. So there's growing
weed.
Growing weed.
Right. But I still think it's illegal to drive when you're high.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what it said on there, that it's illegal.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so here we have. So here we have moms, dads, and kids all believe, to your point of.
Oh, no, a third of them believe.
6% of, I mean, they are at one with margin of error, so. Yeah, I thought that was pretty fascinating.
I'm blown away by it, actually.
Blown away?
Yeah. Right.
Boy, the puns can go on all day.
All day long. Okay, Gary, one of the things you wanted to talk about was Volvo had this performance brand called Polestar, and now they're sort of rebranding it as an electric or electrified brand and making it a standalone company.
They introduced the Polestar 1, a two-door, two-plus-two Grand Tourer coupe with an electric hybrid performance.
A two-plus-two Volvo.
Polestar 1.
In fact, here's the picture of it.
And
right now.
So its output is 600 horsepower and 1,000 newton meters of torque. Carbon fiber body. They're using Volvo's scalable platform architecture, which underpins lots of stuff that they're doing now.
The XC90, the XC60,
it looks pretty
the
good.
S90.
Yeah.
And they only sell it as an electric car, right?
This one's a hybrid.
And so the next one.
So then they're going to the next one, the Polestar 2, will be a full battery electric vehicle. Which will go after the Tesla Model 3, and then they'll come out with a larger SUV-style battery electric vehicle, the Polestar 3. But what's interesting is all ordering will be done online, and what they're doing is that basically you're not buying it, you're buying a subscription to this. So you'll have like a 2 or 3 year subscription, and so they'll be able to swap out for something else.
I wonder if you can.
That might work in China, maybe even Sweden. Well, I'm not sure you can get around the franchise.
I was going to say, you're buying an end run around the dealer.
Well, yeah, I mean, so they're even, there's a purpose-built Polestar production center being built in Chengdu, China. So, I mean, these guys are really focused on that. But I mean, it's, you know.
So this is like the book by Cadillac.
Exactly.
Subscription model where you can get, you know.
Whatever's in the lineup.
Yeah, whatever they've got.
I know, Porsche's talked about doing the same.
Porsche. Well, and then that company, Link & Co.,
right,
which is also owned by Geely, which owns Volvo, which then, of course, owns Polestar, has said that its vehicles will not be purchased vehicles. They will also be subscription-based models, and people will be able to swap it out. So, yeah, I mean, this you know, so you got the book by Cadillac, that thing that Porsche announced a couple weeks ago.
And apparently, book by Cadillac's fully subscribed for the number of vehicles that they have in their fleet.
It's working.
It's maxed out. Yeah,
but they're only doing it in New York, right?
It's a pilot program.
I want to say it's 2,000 a month. I thought Porsche is talking about 3,000 a month.
I thought it was 1,000 a month.
I thought it was
for Cadillac.
Well, maybe I got that wrong. Maybe it's 1,000.
But think about that. There's nothing that they sell that you would lease for 1,000 a month. I mean, you know, even the fully loaded CT6 that goes for like $91,000 is not going to cost you $1,000 a month on a lease.
Correct.
You're paying for the versatility and having a new car all the time.
Yeah, you swap out whatever vehicle you want to get
on a regular
basis. Think about it. You always have a new car, right?
Right.
Because it's if you lease a three-year-old CT6, after 2.5 years, you have a 2.5-year-old car. But with this, you know, with these programs, you're always in a brand new car.
I hadn't thought about that.
All right.
Right.
All right. So it's 15. So you split the difference. It's $1,500 a month.
Yeah, okay, right. Maybe Porsche's $2,000.
So Porsche starts at $2,000 a month, but to get access to every Passport vehicle, their thing is being called Passport. Members have to spring for the premium version that costs $3,000 a month. So for $1,500 for Cadillac, you get access to platinum trim models like the Escalade and CT6, and you get V-Series cars as well thrown in there.
I do wonder how long they keep them in the fleet. Because, I mean, the cars wouldn't be brand new necessarily, right? It might be like, you know, a few thousand miles on them, or depending on how long if they keep in the fleet for 30,000 miles, then the cars aren't brand new, but they're relatively new.
Sure. And that's what I would expect them. I mean, that's what the daily rentals do.
Right. Like,
that's kind of the 30, model. 30,000 and, pull it.
But it's sort of interesting. I mean, it's almost like maybe leasing has run out of gas and they're trying to find another way of getting that revenue.
Well, I think that the theory here is that ride sharing, not ride hailing, mind you, Uber and Lyft are ride hailing. That's basically, you know, a cab, except you don't want a smelly old yellow car with a guy with a medallion. You want, you know, a smelly different kind of car.
With no medallion.
With a guy with no medallion.
That's right. But it's cheaper. But you mean car sharing.
Yeah, it's their way of battling car sharing because they're offering you different kinds of rides. If you're going on a weekend road trip, you get the Escalade because you need the space. If it's just, you know, you and the wife taking off on a weekend road trip, you just want a nice car because you don't have the kids and the dog and everything like that, you know, and that sort of thing. Or you're going on a beach trip and you just want to convert, you can get whatever you want. And because that's what some of these new services do. You go on and you can get, you know, you can get a car, get a Ferrari if someone will put their car in this car, their Ferrari in a car sharing fleet. That's the kind of thing that they're banking on people really want. I think where this gets into trouble is there's already an app out there where, John, you can put your Citroën in there if you wanted to. I can put my Mini in there. And it's totally ecumenical, where, you know, you can go and get any car you want. So if someone else does this, let's say Hertz with their, you know, what is it, Hertz Platinum or whatever their, you know, their Hertz Gold, their high-end program where you can rent cars, what if they decide to offer a subscription like this? Then I don't have to just choose what Cadillac has or just choose what Porsche has. I can get anything from anybody. And why wouldn't I want that? Maybe I want a 5 Series this weekend, and I want a, you know, Panamera next weekend, and during the week I just want a CTS. I
mean, or maybe during the week you use that smelly guy who you've called up on your phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can afford the Panamera next week.
Well, I mean, the thing that I wonder about is, I mean, so look, you know, the book by Cadillac being in New York, okay, so, I mean, maybe people don't want cars during the week because they'd have to park them, right? And you'd have all the costs associated with that. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if you could only have the car, whatever car?
$1,500 a month's a lot of money just for renting a car every weekend.
For some people, it's nothing. And that's who they're getting to pay this kind of money. This is why Porsche is going to be able to charge $2,000. For some people, that's nothing.
No, I know, but it's...
For the rest of us, no. And that's why I'm intrigued by what Maven's doing. Here's another car-sharing model where GM is now taking off-lease cars and putting them into Maven. Because this industry's choking on off-lease cars now, and it's only going to get worse. David, you guys have reported about this a lot.
Yeah, they're trying to make revenue off of the car. While particularly now the used car market is still pretty soft. So you go back, you lose money on it. It's making leasing, and will for, you know, until this glut of off-lease cars thins out. I mean, you got this pig in the python rolling through over the next couple of years. So rather than dump that car off in the used car market and lose money, they put that day of reckoning off, and they make revenue on it in the meantime. In fact, I had this in one of my stories. Maven said that, you know, they, because of that, it is a net profitable venture for GM. If you consider what they aren't losing by taking all these cars, particularly the passenger cars that come off lease, because that's a really soft market right now.
So, well, Malibus and cruises and things like
correct.
That.
Even Camaros. I mean, they've got rid of a shift there. I'm sure those are probably doing poorly in the used car market, too.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got different questions. We've even got a phone call that's waiting to get in on this. But first, we got to take another break and give a shout-out to our friends at Hyundai. Okay, let's see. Wright Knight's written back yet again. He wants to know, why is GM Cadillac taking so long with their turbo 32-valve V8? I don't know anything about it.
I don't know. I'm the finance guy.
Yeah. Okay, our work wrote in, kind of too bad Magna was not the successful bidder for Chrysler back when. Remember, Magna came that close to buying Chrysler. How about Magna building the Model 3? It'd probably get built. Or how about Toyota
getting built just in small numbers?
Yeah. Right. Or how about Toyota taking back the Fremont plant, as they seem to be the ones that solved the bad labor problems GM had there? That is, to take it back and manage building the Model 3. Well, that, we know that's not going to happen.
Right.
But interesting.
I think Toyota will buy Tesla before that happens.
Okay, and we got this phone call here. So, Carmen, let's bring that in.
This is Clem Zarovsky at Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, has your company had any conversations with automobile insurance companies about getting a discount for having these safety features on their car? I remember years ago I got a discount on my auto insurance because the car had anti-lock brakes. Thank you.
Yeah. Good question. Obviously, that was for Swami, although typically suppliers don't get involved in those kinds of conversations.
Right. I think you just get lower rates if you've got a newer car that has a lot of the safety features on it.
I think it depends on the insurance provider. I know Allstate, for example, has been one that's been pretty progressive about doing that, to name another insurance company. But, yeah, you got to talk to your insurance company. But in some cases, especially with this forward collision warning with full brake, you should be able to get something like, I want to say, like a 10% discount.
Yeah, I seem to recall the last time we got insurance that there were, like, check boxes for various technologies, if you had them or not, and, you know, you'd get a discount as a result of that. But, I mean, isn't it like Liberty Mutual that has a dongle that you plug into the CAN bus?
So the OBD2
port, yeah.
Yeah, right. And they monitor how you drive.
Yeah.
And
as much as you drive, and
you drive like grandma or grandpa, they give you their blessing. And if not, your rates go up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who's going to volunteer for that?
Grandpa. Yeah. People do.
Yeah. They're waiting for that check to come from the insurance company rather than the other way around.
Right. I don't think anybody in this room is going to volunteer for that program.
No way. Hell no. We couldn't get out of the parking lot without breaking the law.
Folks. Yeah. Your policy.
Okay, Gary, what else do you got on your list?
I thought it was sort of, you know, this is Schadenfreude, I guess. So yesterday, the Ford F-Series was awarded the Truck of Texas. So this has been awarded 24 times. F-Series has gotten it 14 of the 24 times. And yesterday, they also announced that there was a 1.3 million F-Series recall for vehicles that were built
That's 2015 the door latch thing?
Yeah, the door latch.
Because the door latch didn't have a water guard or a splash guard, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought the door was coming open.
Well, it won't shut necessarily. So it won't open or
but
it won't close.
It needs to shut.
It does.
One would like to think. It's usually a feature of cars that they have doors that shut.
Probably the cause of this water guard or splash guard, is a little piece of flat, clear plastic. And probably about 1.3 million vehicles later, somebody went, hey, what are all these splash guards doing in the back room in the boxes?
So you think they were there, they just weren't installed?
I don't know. But, this is probably something that came in from a supplier.
Blame the supplier.
Well, blame the supplier.
Now that Swami's gone, you're blaming the supplier.
But Geez, I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of ironic.
Hey, there's no excuses on this one. Overland stagecoaches had door latches that latched, stayed closed.
Right.
They've been at this for a long time.
Okay, what else?
So Daimler, you might have some insights on this. Daimler talking about dividing Mercedes-Benz cars and vans, and then Daimler trucks and buses, and then a financial services business. So you'd have three standalone businesses.
They've talked about basically not splitting up the company as in spinning anything out, but just organizing it internally so that they can do this. And look, what I think, you've seen General Motors stock go up quite a bit in the past
couple months or so.
And a lot of that has happened because, you know, they have a pretty good technology story, right? They showed off an electric car strategy. They have been mass producing autonomous Bolts or starting that process. And that says that they're in the game, you know, arguably at the front of the pack in both of those competitions, right? So that's helped the stock. But the other thing is the sum of the parts theory that, you know, GM is ahead, so you can spin out their mobility business, which doesn't exist yet. You could spin out Cadillac, was what one of the analysts said, in the same way that Fiat Chrysler has spun out Ferrari. You could spin out GM Financial. So what Daimler has done is they've essentially, it looks like, siloed groups of their businesses that if they wanted to, if it ever made sense, they could spin out. And really, the real impetus was, you know, Fiat Chrysler, you know, most people thought it was, you know, one of the smaller, weaker car companies in the world. But you spin out Ferrari. They've been trying to sell their parts division, Magneti Marelli, unsuccessfully. But they're now working on spinning that out. They've talked about, you know, maybe spinning out Jeep, or at least it's been speculated. And a lot of that is, you know, this sum of the parts, you know, you spin out Jeep, and Jeep actually probably would be worth a ton of money separate of this company.
Yeah.
You got to find a buyer for the rump.
What I think Mercedes is doing is taking a page out of Volkswagen's playbook, because Audi is a standalone company whose major shareholder is the Volkswagen AG group. But you, me and I, we can all go out and buy stock in Audi. You can buy stock in Porsche, too. It's a standalone legal entity whose major shareholder, and I mean major, like 97% of the stock is owned by Volkswagen AG. But I think it possibly allows investors to say, you know, I'm not interested in vans and trucks trucks and buses. I don't care about that. But this Mercedes car thing, I think that, or maybe, so it allows you as an investor to go into specific parts of the company.
If they're going to give you access to a security that represents just that business. And that's what I mean by a spin out. You know, when Ferrari was first spun out, FCA still owned a chunk of shares, and eventually they sold it all off, and now it's totally independent. But that's often how these go. There's been talk about Tata Motors spinning Jag Land Rover out for something. It's never happened, but there was, you know, I don't know if it was investor pressure, but there was speculation that they could do that. And one of the reasons why, for a while, Tata Motors, that the Tata brand was losing money. And if you just took Jag Land Rover's profit and multiplied it by a typical earnings multiple that car companies traded, it was worth more than the entire Tata Jag Land Rover empire altogether, which meant that Tata had negative value. And so if you had sold Jag Land Rover separately, you'd get more value. That's the sort of theory with Jeep. And that's why, to your point, you get, by kind of siloing these things, you could at some point give investors a crack at investing in just that kind of business. And you really, Daimler, you think about it, you know, big part of the business is commercial trucks, which is a very different business from selling retail cars.
Very different. Totally different. Hey, we got another phone call here in from New York. Carmen, let's bring that in.
Hi, Dick Lembitz calling again from York, Pennsylvania. What do you think? Is Chevrolet going to take advantage of Ford's problem with the recall of all those police cruisers?
Yeah, good question.
That was
York, not New York.
Yeah, the emissions,
there was exhaust leaking into the cabins of police cruisers, Ford Explorers. Real problem. Look, Ford's going to fix these things, presumably. It's blaming the upfitters who have drilled holes through the body, and that's letting exhaust leak in. That's what Ford's claiming, at least. But these police departments have bought these things. Now, if I were Chevy and trying to get somebody to buy something new, not just fix what they got, you bet I'd say, boy, you don't want to buy those Fords. You're going to poison the cops on the force.
Yeah, so, but so what, Ed Pieper runs the fleet business, and he's a very nice guy.
Chevy is
not going to throw grenades.
I think they still have Tahoe. They did. I don't know if they still do.
Do they not sell Impala police cars? There are a lot of front drive.
Well, Caprices. And Caprices are still there. You know, they're importing them from Australia, right? But now
they're still doing that?
Well, it's just stopped. I mean, Holden no longer builds cars. The last one just rolled off the line. So
I didn't even know they were still bringing. Well, they had the SS coming up here for a while, so maybe they were still.
Yeah, no.
Until recently.
This year, they have been selling Caprice police cars. And I believe they still have Tahoes as well.
The Impala's big enough, and I've seen front drive police cars. They really want the rear drive body on frame cars, though.
Hey, one last topic I wanted to get into. We've been talking all this autonomy stuff. Cruise automation is making, I think, stupendous progress. There's some pretty good stuff of Chevy Bolt autonomous cars. I don't know how to say the guy's name. David, maybe you know this, who runs Cruise Automation.
Kyle Vogt.
Kyle Vogt? Is that how you say it?
Pretty sure, yeah.
I've never seen or heard anybody pronounce the name. But, he put out a couple of clips where they've got a Bolt going through San Francisco, and it comes to this six-way intersection. And it's all flashing red lights around the intersection. And there's pedestrians, and there's food carts, and there's cars, and this thing gets right through it, no problem. I mean, it doesn't just sail through. It's stopping, moving over, letting stuff go like a person would. Then there's another example of it comes up to a construction site. There's a construction worker standing in the street with a reflective vest and a hard hat, and he holds out his hand, and the car comes to a stop. Then he looks both ways to see traffic is clear. He beckons the car to come towards him, and it starts going. And then he, motions it off to the right, and the car does this whole thing just reading the hand signals of this construction worker. Pretty good stuff.
It's interesting. He Voigt has been sort of trash-talking Waymo, saying, we have our cars in San Francisco. You guys are in Chandler, Arizona. There's like nothing in Chandler, Arizona, but we're in the midst of things.
It's a mighty fine sight to see.
Well, in fact, what Kyle said is 1 minute of testing in San Francisco is worth an hour in Chandler because of all the crazy stuff.
Well, now they're testing in New York,
now they're going to New York.
Super congested and people running and out in crosswalks in front of you and. Look, I lived there for a while. One of the most dangerous things when you're walking the streets in New York are the bicycle messengers. Those guys just haul through everything. I mean, I've almost been run over by them half a dozen times. But look, that makes for a challenging environment for self-driving cars. GM sort of, quietly sneaked up on everybody and has really gotten arguably a leadership position, although look, very difficult in this kind of game because Toyota never talks about this. You can't tell me they don't have some good self-driving technology.
Oh, they do.
They were doing self-parking Priuses and Lexuses, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I never could get the Lexus system to work. I thought the Ford system was way better.
But you know what I mean. They've been working on this stuff for a long time.
And just in the last couple of weeks, Toyota has shown videos of what they're at. But they're playing catch-up. I mean, only 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, Toyota was poo-pooing the idea of autonomous cars. And then Akio got religion, and they're spending big time. That's why they've put in this whole big artificial intelligence push in the United States at MIT, University of Michigan.
All I'm saying is it's always tough to say who's really out in front in something like this because we only see what they've decided to show us.
Yeah.
But, GM... they bought Cruise Automation a year ago or not even, and they sort of took some shots for possibly overpaying, and here they are with a system that's being mass-produced and driving cars around in a number of cities that drive themselves. It really put them in the game in a very big way.
Okay, we got a couple of more questions that are coming in because we're getting to the end here. Mark K. wants to know, do you think China will buy Chrysler? and use it to bring Chinese cars to the USA.
I was talking to Larry Veliket, who covers FCA for Automotive News, just this earlier this week, and you know, he said that there's been, I mean, one of the reasons why FCA's stock price is so high is because there had been some
rumors,
discussions of this thing, but it doesn't seem to be coming through. So the question is, who and why?
Yeah. Well, look, and how? Because Great Wall had this thing where the CEO said to Automotive News she'd like to buy a Jeep, or they don't have the money. And only the very biggest Chinese companies would even be able to raise the money, because Fiat Chrysler is worth a lot of money right now. So they have to have the cash to do it. Or the Agnelli family has to be willing to take stock in this merged entity of, say, Geely, Fiat Chrysler, or whatever it would be, to get that done. And, you know, this is a really big deal for one of these companies. Just the financials have it very big to pull off. And, and that's why they were pushing GM hard, because they knew the Fords would never delete their stockholding with a big merger like that. You know, the Ford family wouldn't. There's no GM family, so GM had a lot of cash. GM has valuable stock, and they could merge the company. And the Agnellis, instead of owning 25-30% of FCA, would own, you know, whatever it is, 10-12% of GM FCA. So they're still in the game. They still have a big stake, but they get cashed out with a lot of money. And FCA is in the hands of somebody who has electric drive technology, autonomous technology, all the stuff Fiat Chrysler isn't really working on. So they've taken their company. They've put it in good hands. You know, so the driving factors you have to look at are what makes industrial sense, who has the cash stock value to actually do it, who has the technology that makes sense for this whole thing to happen. And the OEs are very worried about the appearance that they're taking this Italian icon and hiving it off to somebody else just to make some money. I mean, yeah, they'll be rich and nobody can bother them in Italy, but they really don't want to be Italian robber barons.
They have their reputation to uphold.
Yeah, and look, politics in Italy is not like politics in the U.S. There are steeper consequences for making everybody angry than just being flamed on social media in some of these other places.
Okay, we got one last question, and I think this is a good way to wrap up today's show. And I'm probably going to butcher the name. It's either Levant or Levante. Says, I'm looking for another car for me to drive to high school. I was looking into a 2017 Kia Optima SX Turbo. My parents are buying it. What do you guys think about the car?
The Optima's a nice car.
Yeah?
I mean, I don't know what else he's looking at. I tend to, when people ask me if they should buy something. So first of all, usually when somebody says, what do you think of the Optima? Well, what they mean is there any reason on earth why I shouldn't buy this car that I'm already dead set on buying?
Yeah.
So the answer to that is no.
Yeah, I'm surprised it isn't, you know, what do you think about the Civic? I mean, it's just if he's going to high school.
Yeah. Well, you know, number one, I think the Optima is a good car. You're getting the turbo. It's got some performance to it. It's the SX. It's the sport model. Mm-hmm. Really. So all that's good. It's a car that really hasn't sold well. You might even look at getting a good used one, like getting a certified pre-owned version of it and save
Does
about
it. Do you do that? Do they have certified pre-owned?
I think everybody has a CPO program, right?
I don't know. But in any case, if you buy a brand new one, I wouldn't buy it. I would lease it because it's going to drop in value. It's a great car, but passenger cars are not selling well. You're going to lose your butt on this thing.
Although he could get a great deal.
He could get a great deal.
I mean, he could go into the dealership for the new one, and it'd be like,
I know.
Make that used car look like it's overpriced.
Possibly. You'd have to go and look at what's going on. And his previous, thank you, Levant or Levante. I owned a 2011 Saab 9.5 Aero. So
2011? Did they make?
Yeah, 9.5 Aeros.
In 2011? Saab?
You know, that's a good question. Because GM, when did GM dump Saab? That was in the bankruptcy before.
They were trying to sell Saab. In fact, I think they did eventually sell some of the assets.
Victor Mueller was running the company then.
At that point, I think.
And remember, somebody was trying to buy it. It was like Stryker or somebody like that.
Yeah, it was still a good-looking car.
It was Victor Mueller who was the Stryker guy.
That's right.
Then he was trying to sell
it. So I guess there was a 20. I didn't think they made him into 2011. Right now, whenever I see a Pontiac, I think, boy, that car's already old. It doesn't look it, but it's already really old. And I see an Oldsmobile on there, and you see a lot of Oldsmobiles around here. It's like, oh, boy, that's putting years on it. Then you think about it, it's a 20-year-old car. But, yeah, they were making Saabs until not that long ago.
And one thing about the Optima, it surprises me every time I get in one, is how big that car is. I mean, it doesn't seem like a mid-sized car. It doesn't seem like a Malibu or a Fusion. It
seems full-size.
It's
a good-looking car. You know, you might have a good point that he should be able to get a killer deal on it. But I'm telling you, they can't give those cars away.
Like a $5,000 rebate. Someone would probably look it up while we're sitting here, but there've got to be some big rebates.
There's got to be some rebates. I would check out and see.
Every car plant in the U.S. just about, they've been cutting shifts, slowing line speeds because
they got to make room for those Stingers to come onto the lot.
So. That's right.
I hate driving SUVs, even the new crossovers that are more nimble. I'm a passenger car guy, so when I go to buy something, I'm going to get a nice deal.
Yeah.
Then I'll just get killed on the back end when I go to trade it in. But that's the market.
Okay, let's wrap it up.
Right.
David Welch, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Always great to
have you here. And Gary, let's do it again next week.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, and of course, want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.